Mi wawa, mi wawa.
Welcome to the Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK Radio, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming on the web for the world at www.kpfk.org. My name is Tammy Benglu, and I'm here with my co-host, Manuel Criollo. Today we're going to spend the hour with Vijay Prashad, Associate Professor of International Studies at Trinity College, who will join us to discuss his most recent book, Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World. This book explores the third world not as a place, but a project. And as Vijay writes, where a hope of the anti-colonial era was translated into agenda, a project that new states struggles to enact, and it documents the challenges they face. Stay tuned and we'll be right back. Welcome to the show, Vijay Prashad. Vijay is an associate professor of international studies at Trinity College. His books include The Karma of Brown Folks and Keeping Up with the Down Joneses. The subject of today's interview is his most recent book, The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, published this year by the New Press. Welcome, Vijay, to the show, and good to have you on.
Thanks a lot. Always a pleasure.
Well, you know, often when we write either articles or books, they're a tactic and an intervention. So we'd like to start off with, in writing Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, what was your intention, and what was this an intervention for?
Oh, it's a long story. I had been to Durban for the World Conference Against Racism, and when I returned, I was horrified. A few days later, of course, 9/11 took place. But part of my horror was that all that work of making Durban happen had just disappeared. You know, it seemed that nobody would remember the discussions and deliberations of the international global social movement. So I thought I'd write a book about it, and I tried to write that book, but it became overly critical. And it became, I think, a little too revealing for me that our movement today is not where it should be. And I decided that I didn't want to write that book without first asking what came before it. If our movement today doesn't seem to have the legs that I assume it should have, was there ever a time in the last century when our movement did have those legs? So I went back and I, you know, studied. You know, I've been doing this for about 8 years anyway, reading about the national liberation movements, and I decided to write this book as a way to start a conversation about how there once was a third world project. That is to say, there once was an articulate alternative to global capitalism coming from two-thirds of the world's population. And that agenda, that project, was destroyed in the 1970s and 1980s. So by the time something like Durban comes up in 2001, you know, by the time the kind of World Social Forum comes up, it comes up, in a sense, not out of nothing, but it comes up out of the ashes of a very profound project which was assassinated by the so-called Global North. So I wanted to tell that story so that we can understand, you know, how to make this phoenix that's rising now into something sensible.
Well, I think this book does a great job in making a huge contribution in many different ways, but at least three that I want us to try to explore. Is it really begins to talk around and explain nationalism, not as people understand it necessarily as opposed to internationalism, but the nationalism of the Third World Project as revolutionary and as internationalist. And I think the second one that I think the contribution makes is just in this era of, which is still imperialism, but as people talk about the traits of it as neoliberal globalization, is that there is a diminishing of the role of nation and states as if it's no longer important. I think this really helps shape the complexity of the role states can play and still the fight for self-determination. And I think the third piece is, you know, a real challenge to the postmodern notion that there's no objective reality or social totality, even though we try to hold the complexities of people's personal subjective experiences. So maybe if we could take the first one in terms of you laid out the unity of the third world and the kind of foundations of their nationalism.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting. When you go and read, say, a national history, typically it assumes already that there's a nation and that the historian can then go and just tell the story of the nation. But if you decide, as I did, to study this third world as a project, not just as a always already existing place, you know, as a set of demands brought together by groups of countries, and then you go back and see their national struggles, you get a very different sense. So, for instance, in India or in Indonesia or in Ghana, these were areas colonized by the British and the Dutch. And in these areas, there was an incredible social, cultural diversity. There was no nation in the European sense of people, you know, who have a language in common, have a sort of myth of origin in common, have certain dietary practices in common, etc. Even in Europe, as it turns out, of course, it was by the force of arms that nations were manufactured. You know, school children were taught to speak in a certain way in France. You couldn't speak in the accents of Britannia. You had to actually, you know, learn standard French. But in a place like India or Indonesia or Ghana, it was absurd to think of constructing one culture. So when these, when movements began against colonialism in the 19th century, they took as their principal platform that the colonial ruler must leave, or must somehow give the people in these countries more power. So the unity was founded not on language or on dietary practice, but unity was founded on anti-colonialism. And that was the heart of third world nationalism, that what united people in India was that they wished for the British to leave. What united the Indonesians was that they wished for the Dutch and later the Japanese to leave. And, you know, this is a story that occurs right through the, you know, the colonized world and the semi-colonized world. Places like China, for instance, the unity achieved by, you know, first the Kuomintang in its early period and then later by the Communist Party was in the war against the Japanese occupation and in reviving the stories of the Opium Wars, which they fought against the English colonial entity on the Pacific Rim. So the basis of third world nationalism wasn't that everybody ate, you know, French onion soup. It was that they detested colonialism. And that was quite an open-ended platform on the surface of it. Secondly, because these were relatively isolated movements, their connections between each other had become quite strong from at least the 1920s onwards. This was facilitated by the Third International, by the Comintern, the Communist International, but also it was done purely by happenstance. I mean, the fact that many African countries, some Asian countries had been colonized by the English meant that they would bring from these countries, you know, upwardly mobile children to study at the universities in London or to take the bar. These people would experience discrimination. They would meet each other. So, you know, Nehru would meet Nkrumah, and they would create a friendship. Then in 1928, this friendship that occurred between some of the leaders who had come to study the law or other professions, they came in 1928 to Brussels to a conference organized by the Communist International and the Kuomintang called the League Against Imperialism, the major conference in 1928. At this conference, they said it's not enough for us to think about our national struggles, but we need an international platform because imperialism is not just oppressing one nation. Imperialism is a global system. So they constructed a platform of demands, a very, very, inchoate, elementary platform of demands in 1928 in Brussels. The high point of this internationalist third world nationalism comes at Bandung. In 1955, Bandung is a remarkable little town in Indonesia which has a great history. 29 African and Asian countries come there in 1955, and at this meeting, they put forward a platform of demands which cements in the world's imaginary the Third World Project. You know, this got the goat of the U.S. administration. John Foster Dulles absolutely despised what was happening at Bandung. And it also shifted what happened in Moscow. In Moscow, at this time, they were shocked to see what was coming out of Bandung. And Khrushchev and Bulganin, his prime minister, went on a tour of third world nations celebrating, you know, the Bandung spirit, as they called it. So it's not like this was some, you know, event taking place on the margins of world history. This was at the center of world history in the 50s. An internationalist form of nationalism had come to the table. And what is so scandalous is 50 years later, that memory is erased.
You're listening to KPFK Radio, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and we're speaking with Vijay Prashad on his new book, Darker Nations. You talked about at least the third world unity, the struggle against colonialism and imperialism, so the fight for self-determination. And then with that, it is again, you know, the struggle against racism and cultural chauvinism. And then there was a third one. It said the common denominator was also to preserve and stabilize peace. So it was actually trying to create a peace program.
Well, yes, I mean, you know, we have the memory of ants because, you know, 50 years ago when the United States dropped two nuclear bombs on Japan and then the Soviet Union tested a nuclear device, most people in the world thought the end of humanity is, you know, nigh, and that the end of humanity is going to come because the United States will launch a thermonuclear device, the Soviet Union might launch some kind of device. And, you know, millions of people will be killed. This was a tangible reality. So in 1961, for instance, when the people of Asia, Latin America, Africa, and Yugoslavia met in Belgrade to create the Non-Aligned Movement, which became the heart of this third world project, you know, at that time, as they were meeting in Belgrade, just north of them, in Berlin, there was a major standoff between the, you know, Warsaw Pact countries and NATO. Major standoff. The two sides had withdrawn from nuclear talks. It was the Third World Project that sent their leaders, distinguished world leaders, to Moscow and to Washington, D.C. to say, you people are insane, get back to the table. It's also worth mentioning that in 1957, when the International Atomic Energy Agency was created, it was created partly through pressure from the Third World Bloc inside the United Nations. I mean, at Bandung, the countries, 29 countries, had made it very clear that it would be completely, you know, ludicrous to have an agenda for development, an agenda for cultural cooperation, if the world was going to be destroyed tomorrow, and if everybody was going to have to create nuclear arsenals, which were draining their surplus. So peace had to be one of the main issues. And it is to the credit of the Third World Project that they created through the United Nations some institutions that at least, you know, have remained, walking slightly. I mean, the IAEA, during the lead-up to the Iraq War, for instance, continued to take principled positions inspections should continue, etc. You know, they continued to try to hold back the wrath of the United States government, but of course they were passed by.
You know, I was also thinking that it may be good to help orient our listeners in terms of, we're talking right now about the third world as a project, but where are the origins of the third world as a concept in terms of its term? Where does the genesis of this, and can we understand the backdrop of it being inside the Cold War era?
Well, you know, the term itself, by serendipity, comes from a French demographer who used to write for an important left-wing newspaper in Paris. And, you know, Sauvy, who made the term up, was referring to the French Revolution, where at the time of the revolution, there was an idea that there are three estates. And the third estate was the estate of the bourgeoisie. And what the revolution did was, it took the third estate and said that is the parliament of the people. That the other estates, the clergy, the monarchy, they are all not to be considered as part of, they don't have any sovereignty over people. But the people have sovereignty over themselves. So what Sauvy said when he took that spatial metaphor, first estate, second estate, third estate, he said there's a first world, which is the United States and its allies. There's a second world, which is the Soviet Union and its allies. And then there's a third world, which is the world of the people. I mean, interestingly, Sauvy was providing a very great critique of the bipolar nature of world affairs. And so the term comes by happenstance from him, but the idea has been in play long before 1952 when he wrote that article. I mean, as I mentioned, in 1928 when the countries met at Brussels, you know, people came from Peru, they came from the United States, they came from Asia, Africa, they came from all across what I call the darker nations. And they met in Brussels in 1928 and they provided everything but the name. The name comes later.
Well, Vijay, you know, I think I wanted to go back a little bit on this discussion. You know, me and Tammy were talking before being on the show, how we... You know, we both went to school, to university, and were educated there. And we felt that while we had a very strong leaning toward the support of, you know, revolutionary nationalism and the Third World as a project, much of what we were learning in school, though, was, you know, basically both downplaying it or blacklisting what the Third World, you know, liberation movements were able to do. And I think one of the important things that I thought you were really trying to put forward was, you know, the concept of the nation as a multinationality nation. Second, the secularism. There was a push of, you know, religion as a diversity in religion in most of the third world nations, and multilingualism. And I think that's so contrary to what we're being exposed in many ways, where we basically learn that the, you know, most third world nations were very weak on a lot of these questions, and in fact, contributed to the oppression of old peoples.
Well, I'm not going to, you know, make any claim to when you went to school, but some of this, Manuel, is an ex post facto kind of historical thinking. In that, by the 1980s, by the time the debt crisis had crashed many of these countries and societies, by the time the drought, particularly in Africa and in parts of Asia, had crushed many of these societies, at that time, the Third World platform and project had been severely compromised. And when it was compromised, into that breach entered some of the most reactionary political forces, some of them backed by the United States, but not all of them. You know, all of them were not backed by the U.S. And so, you know, by the time the 1980s comes along and you have people like, in England, you know, Bob Geldof doing a song called Save the World, you know, Feed the Children of Africa. And then the American pop stars pick up on that and you have the classic American thing, which is not Save the World, but We Are the World, you know. By then, the general media image and then emerging the scholarly image is that the Third World was always already a failure. So what the assassination of the Third World now begins to be the history of the Third World. So what you see by the 1980s, which is true, many reactionary political forces coming to the fore, that began to define the entire history of the Third World. And I think that's the way it occurred.
Mm. Well, then, going back into the Third World Project, I mean, you actually document how after Bandung and the Third World Project really sought the United Nations as an arena to try to democratize and as, you know, trying to turn it into an instrument of justice.
Yes, I mean, if you think about it, when the United Nations was being formed, you know, in the early meetings in the 1940s, one interesting feature, by the way, is that because most of the world was still colonized, they had no seats at the UN, at the deliberations, say, in San Francisco on the Human Rights Declaration. You know, India was not seated. Most African countries were not seated. So the lance point for justice was held by the Latin Americans, by people from, interestingly, Cuba, the Dominican Republic. You know, these representatives at the San Francisco meeting joined with the forces that had been created by Eleanor Roosevelt, fought to have an expansive declaration of human rights. Now, that was a very important contribution from Latin America, because what that meant was that by the time the countries were won independence and were seated in the UN, the declaration was something they could use as a kind of constitution. And the UN Charter as well which drew from some of those principles, you know, similar kind of soup of principles, UN Charter and the Declaration of Human Rights. So at the UN, they decided this is a good forum. But the game was cooked, and yet they found a way out of it. It was cooked in this respect, that five countries, at that time they were not nuclear countries, they were non-nuclear powers. Later it just happened that they were all nuclear countries. You know, you can square that circle. The United States, France, Britain, Soviet Union, and China, then nationalist China, in other words, the Kuomintang, these countries were treated as permanent members of the Security Council, and the rest were rotating in the Security Council, and the General Assembly was to be the world's parliament. And the problem was that the Security Council became an undemocratic place that wielded more power than the General Assembly. And in that Security Council, five permanent members were given a veto over any legislation. And this is a very significant problem from the 1940s. And the Third World Project wanted to end this institutionalization of the five permanent members. That was one of their very early demands. End the five permanent memberships and end the veto. Let the General Assembly make policy on security and on everything else. So that was one stumbling block within the United Nations, which they tried to fight, and they continue to fight it as it happens. Second thing, the way around it, was that the Third World Project fought to create institutions in and around the United Nations. Some were already formed, like the Food and Agricultural Organization, which is based in Rome. It was pre-UN, it was absorbed into the UN. But others became very, very important. You know, UNESCO, the UN Education, and, you know, et cetera, that's very important. And the central institution of the Third World Project was created in 1964, and that was UNCTAD, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. It became the central institution for the Third World Project, and it was headed up by a man I write about at some length, the Argentine economist, Raul Prebisch, who, you know, he's a very interesting figure, now forgotten in most places, but he was the first Secretary General of UNCTAD. And UNCTAD provided some of the most important institutional critiques of multinational corporations. And eventually it too was, you know, defanged in the 1970s, and then into the 1990s it was wiped out.
The other piece I wanted to talk about was just the role of the development of nations and self-determination. The Third World, in many ways, was a broad tent. So it's the nations of the developing nations of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Can you talk a little bit about just how they tried to, one, hold that big tent? So if the unity was against colonization and imperialism and against racism and chauvinism and for peace, that was still, it was still within that. Distinctions between the different nations and what they pushed for in terms of social programs.
Well, I mean, they did a ton of things. You know, there were simple things, relatively cheap things, like exchanges of cultural ambassadors, creating magazines in common. I mean, you know, if you look at any national liberation periodical, newspaper, you know, they'll have articles, analyses of what's going on. There's always a poem or a drawing or a short story. It's very interesting to see, because they understood that the imagination has to be expanded as well. The Afro-Asian group created a magazine called The Lotus, which I remember reading as a child as well. So anyway, there were all those. Then there was the expensive thing, was how do you create a new economy? In the 1970s, they institutionalized this with a slogan, the New International Economic Order. But the order was premised on some simple principles, not necessarily even anti-capitalist principles, but simple principles. One of them was that, look, most of us are countries that have come out of colonialism, where we had been reduced to the producer of one raw material. So Cuba, for instance, producing sugar, or, you know, northern Bihar producing, indigo, or some other one country producing, you know, oil, etc. So we are single commodity producers. So they said first we have to diversify. For that, they started using this Prebisch, Raul Prebisch, the Argentine economist, his theory of import substitution in industrialization, create barriers, and also create advantageous trade between countries, affiliated with the Third World Project. So advantageous trade. Outside market laws. So we are not going to sell products at market rates, we'll sell products at fraternal rates. So there were these things. Then they said, look, another way we are getting killed is that multinational corporations have a bottleneck. There are 15 countries that produce cane sugar. There's only two people who buy the cane sugar. They're colluding to set prices. Why don't we, as the producing countries, create a cartel and set prices? So this was a very interesting approach. They tried it with cocoa. They tried it with, aluminium, with bauxite sugar. Many, many different things were tried. The only one that succeeded, of course, was started in 1960 at a meeting in Baghdad, and that is the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, which was a direct child of the Third World Project. And then, of course, it also lost its way. It was created by two of my favorite characters in the book, and I wish I had time and space to write more about them. One is Pablo Perez Alfonso, who is a Venezuelan minister of mines. Very idiosyncratic, strange man. He walked everywhere. He didn't like putting on lights in his house. He believed that Venezuela's oil wealth was for the patrimony of the future. It was for the nation. You know, very strange man. He's an important character. And then in Saudi Arabia, Abdullah Al-Tariqi, very interesting Marxist oil minister, and that's a whole other story. I can tell you, if you'd like, why the book ends in Saudi Arabia. But Al-Tariqi is an interesting man. Again, he understood how the oil markets were working. He had studied in the United States. He had a good grasp of, how oil companies functioned. And Tariqi and Perez Alfonso met in a suburb of Cairo in 59. And they had a discussion, and they sketched out the plan for OPEC. And the next year, OPEC was founded. It's the only successful raw material cartel. But imagine if that raw material cartel idea had spread to, say, sugar, cocoa, coltan, diamonds, and everything else. What a different approach it would have been, a cotton-producing country's cartel, etc. They would have been able to put pressure on multinational corporations.
You're listening to Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK Radio, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. We'll take a short break and be back to continue our conversation with Vijay Prashad on his new book, Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World. Stay tuned.